from Sounds True, Dr. Quantum presents A User's Guide to Your Universe with author and physicist Dr. Fred Allen Wolf. And now Session 1, What is Quantum Physics and Why Do I Care? With Fred Allen Wolf.
We live in strange times. We live in a strange universe. In fact, things seem to be getting more bizarre as time goes on. We've lived through a time of atom bombs, nuclear war possibilities, great fear, Dr. Strangelove, and we now are in a new kind of age. You might call it the age of the computer. You might call it the quantum age or the age of information. It's that quantum age that really interests me and I think is going to interest you. Hi, let me introduce myself. My name is Dr. Fred Allen Wolf, and I'm going to be your guide to, you might call, a user-friendly guide to the universe, or how quantum physics can change your life. This will be an audio course in 12 sessions. And let me tell you a little bit about what's going to be in this course and what you're going to learn. In the first session, we're going to be talking about what is quantum physics and why should I care? I mean, after all, what does it do for me? Why would I even bother listening to this? And what we're going to learn about in this is something that is very bizarre. As I said, we live in strange times, invisible and imaginary, and yet this bizarre, invisible, and imaginary wave actually overturned everything we thought was real. You're going to learn about how that worked and where that wave came from. In the second session, we're going to be talking about not only did that wave overturn everything, but it made us question, is what we're seeing really what's out there? Is there really an out there, or is it all taking place in my mind or somebody's mind? What is all that about? In order to do this, we're going to have to take what is called a quantum leap into the world of mind and matter. In the third session, we're going to ground this a little bit. We're going to see about how your mind relates to your body. We're going to see what consciousness is and what it does. Now, why would I bring this into a course on quantum physics? Because quantum physics has actually changed the way we see and think about our bodies as well as the way we see and think about our minds. So we're going to be looking at how quantum physics and its role in human consciousness has actually changed all that. So a long time ago, a guy by the name of Democritus once said that as we begin to learn this stuff, we have to keep this in mind. He once said, "Wretched intellect, you get your evidence from us and you try to overthrow us. Your victory is your defeat." So we're going to learn something, but we're hoping that we're not going to just overthrow everything we've learned in such a way that we lose everything, but we're going to be gaining a lot more. In the fourth session, we're going to be talking about another bizarre thing which emerges from quantum physics. It's called parallel universes. And we're going to ask you, do you live in parallel universes? And how could I find out if I do? We're going to find out why quantum physics thinks these other universes may be real and how they could be affecting our minds and our human behavior. In the fifth section, we're going to be talking about time and how it bends and space and how it warps. Time bends and space warps? What is that all about? We're going to be looking at what is known as relativity theory that Einstein first introduced some many years ago. And we're going to find out how that, together with some ideas from quantum physics, have completely changed what we think is happening out there. In the sixth session, we're going to be looking at sex, magic, and the shamanic world, how quantum physics and the shamanic world view overlap. Now, this is going to be a very personal story because, you see, the shamanic world I'm talking about isn't a world I just read about. It's a world that I actually entered and became part of. So you're going to learn a little bit more about this character called Dr. Fred Alan Wolfe as he tells you about sex, magic, and the shamanic world. In the seventh session, we're going to be looking at psychology in a new light of quantum physics. We're going to be looking at that strange border where the psyche and physics meet, or how the universe itself may be dreaming reality into existence, including you. In the eighth session, we're going to be looking at the spiritual universe. Can quantum physics give us a new insight into the nature of our spirituality? Is there a spirituality? What is meant by God if we understand quantum physics? And does that have any bearing on my life? In the ninth session, we're going to be looking at mind into matter. We're going to be looking at what is known as alchemy. And we're going to be looking at it from the point of view of the new physics or quantum physics and see that there is a new alchemy. But in order to understand the new, we're going to have to look a little bit into the old alchemy. In the 10th session, we're going to be looking at how matter transforms into feeling inside of your body. Now, that may seem like a very strange thing. Matter changing into feeling? How can that take place? Isn't matter just solid stuff and feeling something effervescent, like, you know, I feel this, I feel that? Well, we're going to look at how the new alchemy provides us a model with what that's all about. In the 11th session, we're going to be looking at a subject that I really like to talk about. It's called time travel. So we're going to do some time traveling through your universe and see how you can use your mind to time travel through time, travel through time, by surrendering something, a little bit of baggage that you normally carry with you that's very precious. What is it? We're going to be learning how to surrender your ego. And the 12th session, we're going to finally be looking at what I call the technology of God. How does God do this? How does this universe get created? And where does it all come from? And how does it affect my soul? So that's our sessions, and I welcome you to tune in. Quantum physics, or quantum mechanics, which really is the same thing, is a strange business. It deals really with the behavior of things we normally don't care about, but affect our everyday lives nevertheless, whether we care about them or not. It deals with the behavior of matter and energy. And let's face it, folks, we are dealing in our everyday lives with taking this hunk of matter we call me, I, our bodies, and moving them through space and time, which we call energy. So just getting around requires us to understand a little bit more about what we mean by matter and energy. But when we think of matter and energy, we normally think of it in terms of the things we can see, like I got a body. I go to a baseball game, I watch the ball travel through the air. I sit in a car and I watch the scenery pass by. I go to work, I do this, I do that. And we see things around us. We see tables, we see chairs, we see clouds, we see the sky, we see the sunrise in the morning. Actually, it's not, but we think it does. The Earth is actually rotating, but we won't get into that detail. Anyway, we deal with matter and energy all of the time. But when we start to look at what matter and energy are made of, that is when we start to go into the sub-world, the world which is just below our immediate perception of the things we normally see, that is, we find that matter and energy behave in a way which is completely contradictory to the way we see the world behave in the large-scale out-there-ness that we call our everyday lives. So what's going on when we're starting to talk about this kind of world? Well, first of all, we have names for the stuff that's in there when we get to that sub-world. We call those things, usually the smallest things of which we're made of, we call them atoms. Now, today we know that atoms themselves are made of even smaller stuff. And if we were to take apart an atom, we'd find that it has a nucleus, which is composed of fairly dense little tiny particles of matter, and electrons, which seem to behave in very bizarre ways, which travel around somehow, if we can think of them as traveling, inside of the atom. And there are many kinds of atoms. There's something like 92 naturally occurring ones, but they all seem to have this rather strange behavior of having everything condensed, most of the matter in the nuclear part, and these electrons whirling around them. So we're going to confine our attention for a moment to just one of those kinds of atoms called hydrogen, and we'll talk a little bit about that. But I just want to point out to you that an atom is really a very small thing. How small is it, Dr. Roof? Well, it's really tiny. For example, if you were to take an atom and you were to inflate it, how big would it have to be before it would be as big as my thumb? Well, to be more precise, suppose I look at my thumb right now and I say, ah, that's my thumb. Ah, it must be a hot day today. I see a little drop of perspiration on the tip of my thumb. Now, what if I were to take this thumb, pretend it was a balloon, and blow it up? Keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And finally, suppose I were to blow my thumb up so it got to be as big as the planet Earth. That's pretty big, right? I mean, we have some ideas of how big that is. If I were to do that, an atom of hydrogen, which is a part of the water molecule of the drop of perspiration that was on my little thumb, that atom of hydrogen would blow up so that it became as big as my actual thumb. In other words, my thumb is in relation to the whole planet Earth as one atom of hydrogen is to a drop of water. Can you imagine? Can you imagine how small an atom really is? And yet these very small things are now entering into our everyday lives, as we're going to find out more as we go through this program. Okay, so now we know how small atoms are. What happens inside of them is even more interesting when we start thinking about what makes atoms interesting at all. What makes them interesting is that they can combine to form things like molecules. But what makes that happen is really something that has nothing to do with what they're made of. It has something to do, rather, with what they're not made of, something which is rather strange and invisible. So let's talk a little bit about that. In order to do that, we have to think a little bit about what we see in the everyday world. For example, I look out there and I see an object. Now, physicists look at objects and they try to figure out, how do objects behave? What are they supposed to be doing? What happens if I do this? Will they go there? Will it go here? What's going to happen if I push here? Will it move over there? All of that is the kind of thing that physicists like to work on. They like to figure out how things work. And that's called mechanics. And mechanics is the kind of thing you do when you're trying to make things work. You're trying to make a car work. You're trying to move something with a lever, with a screwdriver. All of that is mechanics. You want to push here and see something happen over there. That's mechanics. Okay, so what about the mechanics inside of an atom? Well, in order to figure that out, we have to figure out, well, what is actually in there? And if we start thinking about that subatomic particle, that thing we call an electron, remember I told you about it behaving rather weirdly inside of the atom, we find that we have to make a picture in our minds of what we think is going on at that level. Now, making pictures of things is fine. Remember, these things are so small, we can't see them. So we have to imagine what they look like. Now, the simplest idea that we can imagine when dealing with something we want to push around is an object which is small and round, like a billiard ball, or a marble, or a baseball, or a speck of dust, or something that's small, kind of round, and, you know, we can grab it, we can throw it, we can do something with it. So a ball, basically, a spherical object, a dot. We call such things in physics, we call those things particles. particles. And when we think about particles, we physicists, we think about them as little tiny dots or small little things. Actually, there's some new stuff going on right now, which is tending to say maybe they're not dots, maybe they're strings. We'll talk about that later, but let's stay with the dots for a moment. So when we start thinking about these dots, these very small little things, we say, well, how do they behave? Well, we've seen baseballs. If you take a baseball and you throw it in the air, it goes up and then it comes down. Usually not where you throw it, because after all, baseball wouldn't be any fun if all you did was throw it up and down to yourself. So you usually throw it to somebody else, or you hit it with a baseball bat or something like that. And that path that the baseball follows is called a trajectory. That's what we call it in physics. And that trajectory usually has a shape. And as we watch it, we can more or less predict where it's going, how high it's going to go based upon how much force we use to throw it. And that's called classical physics. That's what Isaac Newton figured out a long time ago, including the fact that what goes up must come down. That's called the theory of gravity. That's what he also figured out many, many years ago. So basically, we try to understand the behavior of stuff by watching their paths and try to figure out what are the laws which govern the way things move. Now, that's fine when it comes to baseballs. But when we try to apply the same idea to what is going on at the level of atoms, all of these ideas basically broke down. We first try to imagine that the electrons inside of the atoms were traveling like little satellites around the central core called the nucleus. How we discovered that the atom had a nucleus, well, that goes back to the early turn of the 20th century in 1900, 1901, 1902 through 1905, when a guy by the name of Rutherford, who was a lord from Australia, of all places, discovered that most of the mass of the atom was concentrated into a nucleus at a very tiny core, and the electron had to be whirling around in some way that he didn't understand. So that was how the picture came out, by experiments he did, playing with gold, of all things, and this is what he discovered. Anyway, back to our picture. So we have this electron. How is it moving? Is it going in a circle? Is it going in an elliptical path? Is it going in and out of the nucleus? What is it doing? What is it doing? What is it doing? Well, any time we tried to make a model in which it did anything like that, any kind of path at all, we got the wrong answers for how the atom should behave. In fact, we had to give that all up. And we had to realize that atoms did not behave in the way we thought they should behave. In fact, what we found out was that all these tiny objects did not move like the large objects we see moving around us. What we seem to find is that these little objects kind of were like little jerks. They would jerk from here to there. They would up like that. They wouldn't go continuously. They would just like jump from one to the other, to the other, to the, like a little Mexican jumping bean. Pop, 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 pop. And yet that's what they seemed to be doing. But the funny thing was, when they jerked from here to there, they didn't just jerk by suddenly jumping from one place to the other, although we say the word quantum jump. What they actually did was even more bizarre. They would disappear from where they were and then reappear in another place. Talk about Star Trek transporter and Captain Kirk. That's what we're having. We're having little tiny quantum transporter effects, disappearing and reappearing, disappearing and reappearing, disappearing and reappearing. Finally, when we began to construct the physics of all that, we began to piece together the notion that that's the way matter itself behaves. It isn't constantly on. It's on, off, on, off, on, off, on. It's constantly doing that all the time. And what was trying to teach us something, and something we had to learn, which took a while to grasp, was what made it do that? How was it that it would do that? Why would it go on and off in that very strange way? Well, that was only the first idea that was strange about quantum physics. The next idea was that no matter how we try to figure out the behavior of the world as if it was physically out there, independent of anything I would do except to nudge it once in a while, that still nevertheless existed. We call that objectivity. We call that objective reality. And objectivity means that I'm not involved in it. There's no subjectivity involved in it. There is subjectivity involved in whether I like the taste of that pizza or I don't. But the fact that it's a pizza is objectivity, although maybe in another country they might call it a pizzazza. But I would call it a pizza. I don't know what they would call it in Afghanistan, but I don't know. Whatever they would call it, it would be objectively out there. But the way it tasted to me, that depends on me. That's subjective. That depends on how I looked at it and whether I liked pepperoni or I don't like pepperoni. That depends on me. It doesn't depend on the pizza. The pizza just, I'm a pizza. That's all. I'm here. So we don't, you know, that's the way objectivity and subjectivity get divided. But when we got to the quantum physics of it all, we found this rather strange, bizarre, I told you things are strange, effect that the thing we're looking at, the pizza, could change. It might change into a lemon cake if we looked at it a certain way, or it could be a pizza if we looked at it another way. In other words, how a thing behaved and what it looked like and what it was even changed according to the way we chose to look at it. We could change reality by changing the way we looked at reality. Now, that is something that never existed prior to the discovery of quantum physics. Now, there was a third idea, and this is really the second part of this first session. And that third idea was, well, heaven forbid, I mean, my goodness, how are we going to make any sense of this? There has to be some kind of order, some kind of thing which decides, you know, that there's an order here, there's a regular flow, there's something we can control, there's got to be something going on. How do we get any order in that? Well, quantum physicists, and between, oh, I would say 1920 to 1935 or so, and still going on today, began to develop a series of mathematical relationships. We call those equations. And these relationships govern the behavior of something rather mysterious, which itself connects with these jumping strange objects that we see called atoms and molecules and subatomic particles, including the behavior of large-scale objects as well, that something that we could control, that we can understand, wasn't anything that was itself a particle, a subatomic particle, an electron, a proton. It was none of the things that we could actually grab hold of, but it was something that existed below that level of reality. It was kind of like do 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 do. It was a kind of a magic twilight zone of reality that was halfway something we imagined, and we give a term to that, we call it imaginal, and something halfway real. And that thing that we could gain control over, that thing which gave us an order and gave us some ability to have some control over at least it, although most of it was in our heads, that thing has different names. One name that was given to it is the quantum wave. This quantum wave seemed to be something we absolutely had to have in order to understand the actual behavior of these objects that we see in our everyday world. So the question was, how do we go from this invisible quantum wave into the reality that we see? And that idea is also very strange because it changes our whole notion of time and space in order to even understand that. So that's really the early sessions of physics, quantum physics, that we began to discover as we began to discover this thing, this new physics that we call quantum physics. These are some of the early things that we found out. Now, as we said before, this wave, this invisible imaginary wave, not only affected reality, but implied something underneath reality. And what it implies is something involving mind. In fact, it implies mind so much that some of the founders, when they first discovered this effect, were so disturbed by it that they even said they were unhappy that they ever discovered the thing in the first place. Now, this is a true story. Erwin Schrödinger, the founder of this wave, this invisible wave, this quantum wave, actually said in an interview that if he would have known that this was going to lead to the quantum jumping madness that was discovered, he called it their Verdammte Quantum Springerei, the damned quantum jumping. If he knew that his equations were going to lead to that, he never would have invented the equations of quantum physics in the first place. Anyway, let me tell you a little bit now about just some of the brief history of how this was discovered, because I think some of these ideas will help us understand our own reluctance in discovering something new or trying to live with something new. The first discoveries really took place at the turn of the 20th century. And the guy that made this discovery, the very first one, was a guy by the name of Max Ludwig Ernst Planck, P-L-A-N-C-K. Now, Max Ludwig Ernst Planck was just a typical, ordinary physicist, if anything like that could be imagined. By the way, around the turn of the 20th century, around 1900, do you know how many physicists were alive at that time? Not very many. Maybe 40? Right now, I think there's more than a million on the whole planet. Maybe several million. I don't know if we include all the countries that are currently doing physics. But at that time, maybe 40. I mean, that's about it. It was not the biggest field in the world. Anyway, Max Planck was worried about something that had appeared in his research. He was interested in the behavior of hot bodies. Now, I know if you've got a teenage son out there, he's also interested in the behavior of hot bodies, but that's not the kind of hot body we're talking about here. What we're talking about here is the behavior of things which are hot because their temperature is high. Things like molten steel. In fact, the first time this was noticed might have been when steel mills were operating and people were trying to measure how hot was that steel. Can I pour it yet or not pour it? Because when you look at hot bodies, they do something which tells you they're hot. Namely, they glow. They give off light. And they give off lots of different kinds of light. Red light, yellow light, blue light. And if you look at the different light that comes off these hot bodies, you can actually see different colors. And this is called a spectrum. And you can look at the spectrum of light, and this spectrum of light tells you just how hot the body is. Because that spectrum shifts according to how hot the body is. So what were these guys trying to predict? Well, what they were trying to predict was why the spectrum shifted when things got hotter or colder. And in their explanation, they made a prediction which was so bizarre that it didn't fit what they actually saw. And that made them think, hey, I smell a fish here. Actually, it wasn't quite a fish. It was just a bad calculation. What they predicted was something they called the ultraviolet catastrophe. The ultraviolet, not ultraviolet catastrophe, that we do have a lot of in our time, but an ultraviolet, the violet color. They predicted that as the thing got, hotter, most of the light should be violet and very little of it should be red. But that's not what they observed at all. And Planck said, you know something? I think I see a way out of the problem. And the way to get out of the problem is simply to pretend that the energy and the light is lumpy, like little lumps in your grandmother's oatmeal. Instead of smooth oatmeal, it was lumpy, lumpy oatmeal. And the light coming off from the hot bodies was lumpy. And when he did this, he was actually cheating. He knew this wasn't the right physics, because the right physics predicted the wrong answer. So he said, well, let me do some wrong physics. So let me do some crazy physics. And in 1900, that's what he did. Now, here is Max Planck, very serious physicist, getting up before the German Physical Society on December 14th, 1900, and announcing that he's able to predict the correct spectra of the hot bodies by using lumps rather than continuous flowing energy. Now, you can imagine how hysterical the audience was in receiving the lumpy news. Oh, my God, you would think they'd be jumping up and down and saying, oh, da, da, da. Well, I'll give you a typical reaction of a typical German physicist listening to the talk.
Well, what's for lunch today? What was he talking about? That's crazy. What we're having, Braunschweiger? Oh, that's good. Let's have some Braunschweiger and beer, of course.
And naturally, that's what happened. Everybody, you think when a new idea comes out, everybody's really ready to get it? No, that ain't how it works. When a new idea comes out, people are very reluctant to change the way they've always thought, even when they know it's wrong. Doesn't matter. They don't want to change, and they weren't going to change in 1900. So Planck made this discovery, predicted it, wrote a paper, published it, everything, you know, the Planck idea. Well, by about 4 or 5 years later, people began to pay a little attention to it. And then appears another interesting character on the world stage of physics. His name is Albert Einstein. And Einstein, in 1905, predicted that maybe Herr Planck may have had a good idea. And he actually used the lumpiness of the energy that was coming from the hot bodies to explain a rather new and interesting effect that had been observed before. It was called the photoelectric effect. And what it was this. When you shine light on a metal, electrons boil off. But the light doesn't necessarily boil them off the way you might think. In fact, when you try to predict the way it should work, you would make the following prediction. If I take lots of red light, and a lot of red light, and shine it on the metal, I should get a lot of electrons coming off. But that ain't what happens. All you got to do is shift the light to make it a little bluer, and suddenly the electrons start coming off. Even when there's only one or two, a very weak amount of light hitting the metal, they start coming off. Wait a minute. You mean it doesn't depend on how intense the light is? No, not at all, Matilda. It depends on the frequency of the light. And that was a new idea under the sun. And that was the discovery of what we call photons of light. And that was the first quantum effect. Now, this is 1905, and Mr. Einstein in 1920 received, actually, his Nobel Prize for the discovery of the photoelectric effect and his explanation of it in terms of the behavior of lumps of light in which each lump of energy depended on the frequency of the light. So blue light had more energy than red light, for example. Well, you think, okay, that's how it got discovered. But what does that got to do with all the stuff you were talking about before, this imaginary wave and all this kind of stuff? What about it? Where does that come into the picture? Well, we're not done yet. There's a little more to the story. Now, turns out in 1911, Max Planck, who's now earned some reputation in the German physical ranks, and has the opportunity of presenting Albert Einstein as an honor senior member to the German Physical Society, and he says the following. He says, in spite of his obvious error in the photoelectric effect, because actually, even though I came up with the idea, it's got to be wrong. Wait. He said it's got to be wrong. What is it? It's his own idea. He's saying he himself is wrong. Yeah, we're now looking at, well, the idea was so crazy to him and so crazy to everybody else that they themselves would even reject themselves. Talk about self-loathing. This was really the epitome of it. The physicists loathing of themselves because their idea was too crazy. So in spite, he says, of that, we should let Albert Einstein in, because relativity theory, after all, by the way, that was also discovered in 1905, should be let in. We're going to talk a little bit more about that in an upcoming session. But anyway, here we have a reluctance of the minds of physicists to accept this new physical idea, this lumpiness which suddenly has appeared. By the way, you know, the word quantum means a whole amount of something. So the reason this was called quantum physics or quantum mechanics at all was because it said we're dealing with lumps, not continuous energy anymore. Lumpiness, lumpiness, lumpiness. Quantum, quantum, quantum. That's where the idea came from. Okay, now let's carry the story even further, because this isn't the end of the story. This is just the beginning. In 1913, another physicist, a very mild-mannered, very soft-spoken Danish physicist by the name of Niels Bohr, came to England to get his PhD. He comes to the Cavendish Laboratories in England and works for Sir J.J. Thompson, I think it was. And Thompson, who was running the Cavendish Laboratory at that time, had made the early discovery of the electron and had shown that the electron was a particle, blah, blah, blah. We won't worry about that. Anyway, here comes Bohr into the picture. And Bohr is trying to understand how that electron behaves inside of the atom. And the only way that he can come up with a consistent picture is to say that the electron inside of the atom was traveling in some kind of circle, going in a circle, going in a circle, and then suddenly it disappears. Huh? And then it reappears, traveling in another circle, this time a circle which is closer in towards the nucleus of the atom. Huh? What do you mean? It was, and then it wasn't, and then it was again? What's going on? He called that a quantum jump. And he not only called it a quantum jump, he said it jumped from what was to what could be without going in between. It was Star Trek Transporter, and it really was Star Trek Transporter. That's what was going on. And this was very, very bizarre. Well, you can imagine that this caused a lot of upsets, because people don't like things changing discontinuously. They don't like when things change in random ways. They want control, 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 because after all, that's what science was invented for. It was invented so we can get rational, objective control over the universe, and this is not what we were getting here. What we were getting here was just the opposite of that. Now we're moving into the 20s. In the 20s, we also have the appearance of other characters entering on this world stage. Louis de Broglie, who is a French, I think, a count, comes up with the idea that we should think about the electron in Bohr's model of the atom as not a particle moving in a circle, but somehow guided by an invisible wave. And this invisible wave is really responsible for the way the electron behaves. And the electron doesn't actually jump from one orbit to another, but the wave changes frequency like the wave produced by a trombone. As you go, as you bring the trombone thing back and out, the wave changes continuously, the note changes continuously. They thought the atom really was the electron being caught by a trombone wave changing continuously, and that's why the energy change, because the electron was changing in this trombone wave. And this was de Broglie's idea. Well, the wave became very interesting to people. They said, wait a minute, if this is true, how can it be true? Then good old America across the pond jumps into the scene. And two physicists were working for Bell Laboratories at the time, a guy by the name of Davison and another guy by the name of Germer, actually discovered that electrons behaved like waves. They observed what are called diffraction patterns. You see, these guys were not interested in waves or particles or what electrons were. What they were interested in, as most American innovation is concerned with, practical applications of new ideas. They wanted to build something bigger and better. Bigger and better telephone, better transmission line, whatever they were working on at the time, they needed to work with the science of materials. I think they were working with nickel and cadmium and some other stuff like that. And they were trying to figure out how this stuff behaves, and they were using what is called electron diffraction, electron X-ray patterns, trying to figure out what happened inside of the metal when they shined electrons on the metal. And what they found was the electrons behaved very much like X-rays, which are radiation patterns of electromagnetic energy and not particles themselves, although photons certainly were known to exist by Max Planck's idea and Albert Einstein's idea. But nevertheless, nobody actually seen the electrons, particles, behaving as waves. They've seen waves behaving as particles because light were waves and now they behave as particles, but they never actually saw electrons behaving like waves until Davidson and Germer. Now, when that happened, all hell broke loose across the pond in France and Germany. In fact, when Louis de Broglie first published his thesis, the thesis committee, who hadn't heard about Davidson and Germer yet, said, this idea is so very crazy, we don't know whether we should take it seriously or not. How can particles be waves? They cannot be this way, not at all. So what we should do is ask Albert Einstein. So they said, Mr. Einstein, what do you think? Well, what I think is that actually what we're seeing here is a true picture of the actual reality. So you should take Herr de Broglie very seriously, and you should publish his result. And then, of course, across the pond, we have Davidson and Germer's, and suddenly everybody thinks that electrons aren't little tiny little particles anymore. They're waves. Well, that's how things stood for a while. Waves, particles. Waves, particles. Waves on Monday, Wednesday, Friday. Particles on Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday, and on Sunday, we don't know. That's how it stood for a long time. And then people began to say, this can't be the way things really are. There's got to be another way. We better try to understand what is really going on. And that led into a whole new way of thinking. And that you're going to learn all about in the next section, when we look at, is there an out there, Matilda?
This concludes session one. Our program continues with session two, Taking the Quantum Leap.
The universe is not only queerer than we imagine, but it is queerer than we can imagine, said J.B.S. Haldane, remarking about how strange all this business was. You see, what's been happening here is that we've been dealing with two conflicting, almost paradoxical ways of thinking. What's going on out there? What is stuff made of? Are things made of particles, or are they made of waves? What sense can we make of all that? Well, the story isn't over yet, because a new vision is going to come into this whole picture. We might call it the first inkling that God may be playing craps with the universe. Does God shoot dice? Does probability, possibility, have anything to do with this mix-up between wave and particle? Well, you have to understand. I mean, you really got to understand how really difficult it is and how repugnant it is to think of things changing discontinuously. Pop, 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 pop. That is repugnant. That upsets the apple cart. It means no control. We can't control. And we like to have control. Human beings want to know that when they do this, something else is going to happen. And they want to be able to predict what's going to happen. And physicists are no different than any other human beings, even though we do seem weird to other human beings at times. But nevertheless, we're just like you. So we have this discontinuous behavior of light, and now we have this wavy nature of particles coming in. What the heck is really going on? Let me jump ahead for a moment. In 1954, a guy by the name of Max Born got a Nobel Prize for an idea. Now, Nobel Prizes are often given for experimental discoveries in physics, but not too often for ideas. And Born decided that maybe these waves that had been seen and thought about were something indicating our minds were playing a role in the universe. Now, that's 1954. Now I go back in time to when all of this heyday of wave and particles was coming about. Remember I told you about de Broglie, the French physicist who discovered that the electron in the atom behaves like the wave. And we had Max Planck who discovered that photons, there are little particles of light and they are bumpy, lumpy. We remember those two guys. Okay, well, into this mix comes another guy, and his name is Erwin Schrödinger, or Schrödinger. It's a funny kind of name. He was a kind of a lazy graduate student. And, you know, that's kind of interesting. He was studying to be a graduate student in physics. And his main expertise, the thing he was really interested in, was waves. He was a wavy kind of guy. He liked waves. He knew every kind of wave equation you could possibly write down. And physicists were asking him, look, Schrödinger, maybe for your thesis, for your PhD, you can figure out whether these Louis de Broglie waves that he says are in these atoms, that maybe you could get me an equation to describe this wave. Maybe you can find me an equation that will work. And so Schrödinger thought about it a while, and he came up with the idea. First, he thought, when he wrote the equation down, that these were electromagnetic waves like waves of light. But it turned out they really weren't that. When he actually had to write down his equation, he had to insert a special kind of number into the equation, which is not anything we can normally observe. It's called an imaginary number. And you can get one by taking the square root of a minus one. Now, you all know how to take the square root of one. It's one. Yeah. One times one is one. Yeah, right. So the square root of one is one. Yeah, okay. But what is meant by the square root of minus one? There's no such creature. If I square the square root of minus one, I get minus one. Yeah. But what if you take the square root of minus one? What happens then? What is that? Well, we use a symbol for that. We use a symbol I. This I, which stands for imaginary, it turns out to be very important in these Schrödinger waves, because without that I, these waves not only would not make any sense, they wouldn't lead to what were later to be discovered to be the whole notion of probability, which we're going to come to in a moment. But anyway, when Schrödinger discovered this, he wrote his equation down. He actually got the Nobel Prize for this. Everybody thought, the game is over. Electrons are really waves. We now know everything is waves. Wavy, wavy, wavy. Wavy, gravy, wavy, 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 wavy. There's no particles anywhere to be found. That's what everybody thought. But then we have this guy that got the Nobel Prize in 1954, Max Born. He was interested in experimental physics. He had a laboratory in Germany where he was doing experiments, and he had come to a whole different conclusion about what these waves actually were. Now, here's what he saw. He said, look, when these experiments that we do are looked at carefully, we see particles scattering off of particles. He was in a particle experimental mode. That's what they were doing in his laboratory in Germany. And he never saw any waves at all. He said, it's all particles down there. No waves, no waves. So people said, well, then what the heck is Schrödinger talking about? What are these waves? Where do they come from? How do you make any sense? And he says, well, these are really conveniences. They're ways of thinking. They are really not what's going on in the real world. Particles, particles, particles. That's real in the real world. These are waves of thinking. These are waves of possibility, if you will. They're probability waves. They're waves of possibility. And what we're looking at, when we're all said and done, are probability patterns for where these electrons, these particles, are likely to be found when we do these kinds of experiments. Huh? Wait a minute. You mean Schrödinger's describing waves of probability? Waves of possibility? What in all heaven's name is a wave of possibility? I mean, I know what an ocean wave is. I know what a sound wave is. That's real stuff waving. I mean, I know when real stuff waves what it is. I feel a little bit like the crow in Dumbo. I've seen a peanut stand. I've even heard a rubber band. But I've never seen an elephant fly. I've never, ever seen a wave of possibility. What the heck is that? How can that even be? What is going on there? Well, Max Born didn't even try to answer the question. He just simply said, if we write down these Schrödinger waves and we square them, we multiply them by themselves, they produce probabilities if we fix them up in a certain way. And everybody understood what he meant by fixing them up. It's called normalizing them. Never mind what that means. All that really matters here is that when you do something to Schrödinger's wave, square them, multiply them by themselves in some funny way, what you get are probability patterns. And the probability patterns represent what you see when you do an experiment again and again and again and again and keep repeating. And what you see are a statistical distribution. Now you may think, oh my God, what the heck's all that? Look, Matilda, statistical distributions are what determine how much you pay for your car insurance. Because if you live in San Francisco, where I happen to live, car insurance rates are a little bit higher than if you live in Podunk. Now, if you live in Podunk, you probably pay a very cheap amount of car insurance because you ain't going to hit very much in Podunk. But in San Francisco, we like to play bumper derby wherever we drive. You know, when you're in a crowded city, cars bump into each other, insurance rates go up. Statistically, that is. My car doesn't necessarily bump into another car, but other cars do that, and so I have to pay a higher rate, statistically speaking. Matilda, you're going to live to, I think, maybe 80, 75, 80, 85 possibly. The life expectancy keeps going up. Life expectancy is statistics. It's probability patterns. We know what probability patterns are. We live in probability patterns. We do things according to probability patterns. So when Max Born is saying the particles are following probability patterns, he's saying nothing more than what we commonly understand to be probability patterns. Well, you may think, okay, well, the problem's over. It's over. It's over. But think a moment. Physicists like to deal with stuff that's out there, the real stuff. And probability patterns are not stuff that's out there. They're indications of how stuff that's out there might behave, not will behave, might behave. It's probability, right? So where do these waves of probability, where do they exist? Well, in your head, dummy, in your brain, where you're thinking them. I mean, it's probabilities. You flip a coin, it lands, it's either heads or tails, it's 50-50. That's in your head. I mean, you know, the coin is either heads or it's tails, right? Right? Is it right? Wait a minute. Maybe that isn't right. Are these probability patterns just in the head, in the brain, in the mind? Or do they really exist out there in the physical universe? And if they do, then is there really an out there, separated from the in here that I call my mind? This is the debate that begins to emerge in the great fertile time period in the 20s and 30s, 1920s, 1930s, with the discoveries of quantum physics and the theoretical structures of quantum physics. So, if I had a time machine and I could return to any period of time I would like, where would I go? Well, I know where I would go. I love the roaring 20s. I don't know why I love it, but I just do. And what country would I go to? This might surprise you, but I wouldn't go to the United States. Where I would go would be Berlin, Germany. I don't know why. Post-World War I Germany fascinates me. I love the pseudo-decadence and the cafe society life. And I love the music of Bertolt Brecht. And I loved the literary style of Thomas Mann. I loved the Bauhaus art scene of Germany and design and the outrageous Dada of art, which was emerging at that time. This was called authentic reality. In those days, it was an interesting time. It was through the abolition of what we would call normal traditional culture and aesthetic forms. It really was the time of, you might call it, comic derision. But during this period, irrationality, chance, intuition were guiding principles. Freud was already out. Jung and Adler were in. Life had a kind of cabaret feeling. And the physicist, of course, had been born and raised in that ambiance, in that atmosphere, in that environment, and they were pretty young and enthusiastic. Of course, now Max Planck is now 60. Oh, boy. Einstein had passed his 40th. Bohr was a middle-aged 35. So these are the guys. It was the Dada physics area. And where was it happening? Turned out it was happening in a city called Göttingen, Germany. It was an early summer period of time. And at that time, Professor Niels Bohr had come a-calling. Now, Bohr, and this is in the 20s now, Bohr's great discoveries and so forth were like 1913. So he was a respected figure. And in fact, he was such a respected figure that he was given an institute in Denmark, in Copenhagen, from which we now have, or what physicists refer to, as the Copenhagen School of Physics. So he had come to lecture. Now, in the crowd was a very young guy. He couldn't have been more than 20 years old. And this guy suffered from asthma. Very bright guy, and was very enthused to come to hear Niels Bohr speak. And when he listened, and later afterwards in a book recalled his interesting listening to Bohr's lecture in that mild summer day when Bohr came a-calling to Göttingen, he said he actually had asked Bohr some questions. He said, Bohr must have gathered that my remarks sprang from some profound interest in his atomic theory. He replied hesitantly and asked me to join him in the afternoon on a walk over the Hain Mountain, which we took. The walk was to have profound repercussions on my thinking and even on my whole scientific career. Or perhaps it is more correct to say that my real scientific career began on that afternoon. Bohr's remark reminded me that atoms were not things. Who was this guy? His name was Werner Heisenberg, and he was the discoverer of something which was later called the principle of indeterminism, or the principle of uncertainty, or for short, the uncertainty principle. If atoms were not things, then what the heck were they? Heisenberg had completely broken with classical tradition at this point. He was really the first to see that in order to really understand this thing we call quantum physics, we have to give up our reluctance to accept the new ideas which have sprung forth. Atoms were not things. They were not objects. There was something involving mind in a new way. And it was this new way of seeing, that really led him to formulate the uncertainty principle. Now, what does the uncertainty principle really say? It says that in the act of looking at something, you disturb it. You can't look without changing. You can't look without changing. Now, in Zen Buddhism, there's an old koan which has to do with how do you remove a thorn? And the answer is you use another thorn. Well, that's interesting. But you see, in removing the thorn, you cause more damage than the original thorn because you have to use another thorn. In other words, you can't remove a thorn without changing things by using another thorn. In the Heisenberg world picture, anything we used to look at what's going on disturbed what's going on. Now, what is that like? Well, I want you to imagine that you live in a world which is habitated by elves. Little tiny creatures are running around. Little elves, these little tiny guys and gals are running around. And you're a big lummox. You're a big guy. You're a human being. You know, but you live in the world. They're all over the place. And one day they invite you to tea. That's kind of dumb. I mean, you're a big guy and he's a little tiny. And how the hell is that? Are you going to go into their house? But they say, no, come to tea. And so you decide, okay, I'll go to tea. So you go to have tea with the little tiny elves. And the minute you open up the door to their little house to try to get in, the very act that you have of grabbing hold of that little door and opening the door shakes the house so badly that all the elves inside are spilled all over the place. The tea goes all over the place, and the tables go all over the place. Everything's all upset. And they're very mad, these little elves. In fact, anytime you try to grab a cup of tea, you either get it and crush it out of existence, or you miss it entirely because, you know, the so tiny. And anytime you try to, you know, do anything with the elf house, it just jumps and jumps and jumps and jumps and jiggles and zigs and zags and bumps and jumps. And you know, it's just all over the place. In fact, it's so much all over the place that you don't really know whether the elves actually live in a house like you imagine the house to look like your house at all. Because all you ever see is jumpily. You never see any real little house just sitting there. Because anytime you try to look at it, you got to do something to look at it. You got to grab hold of it. You got to see it. And you got to use light. And whatever you use to look at it causes it to jump around. Is there really an elf house out there? Or is there only out there what we imagined to be out there? This is what the Heisenberg uncertainty principle brought us to have to face. It said that maybe there's something else going on out there and that we need to discover what that is. Okay, so here's Heisenberg. He's telling us that maybe things aren't the way they look. But then how is it that things look the way they look at all? I mean, how do things look come from? Why do they look that way? And so Heisenberg began to piece together a story of why things look the way they look. And so he began to work with Born's idea that everything is, you know, these are waves of possibility or waves of probability and so forth. And he began to piece together the idea that atoms were not things, but thinginess may be something that emerges from our acts of observation. In other words, when we look, we bring something to bear, which brings out a thing to look like a thing, and that's not really a thing before we look to bring it out as a thing. Now, Let me tell you what's going on from another point of view. Let's leave Heisenberg out for a little moment. Remember our fellow Schrödinger, who says everything's wavy, and his equation predicts everything's wavy. And in fact, it even predicts what would happen to electrons moving along in wires, like when they make electricity. And what he predicted was the following rather strange story. The electron wave, which may start out as very concisely pointed at one particular place, as that little wave moves, you can imagine it moving as if it were a pulse on a jump rope. You've seen kids play jump rope. And you know that if you grab a jump rope and you give it a quick wiggle, you see a pulse travel down the jump rope from where you moved it up and down, down the line to the other person at the other end. That's called a pulse, right? So you can imagine that from the point of view of Schrödinger's wave, that the electron would move something like that pulse on the rope. Don't ask what the wave is waving in, because we don't know that yet, but just imagine that it's moving like that. Okay, well, here's what happens, though. If the electron were a pulse like that and it were moving like that, what would happen is as time went on, that pulse would get fatter. It suffers from what's called the syndrome of middle-agedness. Not only do I get middle-aged, I get not middle-aged spread. I get fatter as I get older. I wish it wasn't true, but it's true. So, and electrons do the same thing. They get fatter as they move on, as they get older, as they travel on in time. They just get bigger and bigger. And in fact, you can calculate how long it would take for an electron to grow, say, a certain size. It turns out that in less than a minute, an electron would grow to be the size of, say, the Pentagon in Washington, D.C. A little later, it could even grow even bigger than that. In other words, if you start off with an electron inside of an atom and let it go, it would grow to the size of a Pentagon in a very short period of time. Now, we've all seen things, and we've all seen that, or all believe that, things are made of things like electrons, and I've never seen an electron as big as a pentagon. I mean, you know, that's just like, how can that be? How can these electrons grow that to be that big? That's what quantum theory was predicting, and quantum theory so far was accurately predicting a lot of other stuff, but this prediction was too bizarre. So in comes Heisenberg and he says, wait a minute. They don't grow that big because something happens to them before they get that big. And everybody says, what? Tell us. And he says, what happens is you observe them. Oh, and when you observe them, you cut them down the size. In other words, the act of observation changes an electron from being bigger to something smaller and more electronic-like because it's being observed. So as it's being continuously observed, it more or less stays in a small pattern and looks very much like it's supposed to look. In other words, you bring reality into its reality by observing reality. In other words, when you observe, things change into the ways that you choose to observe them. This was the picture that emerged, that electrons did not spread out to be the size of a pentagon. They stayed in their size because consciousness, mind, observation was playing some kind of role. Now, this was a very strange idea. And you might think, well, was it acceptable to physicists? And I want to tell you, it wasn't. It was too bizarre. Nobody in physics wanted to accept the idea that the minds of the physicists were affecting reality. That was too much. That was just too much. There was this uncertainty principle, but they thought it was just something inherent in nature that you couldn't know everything about a particle at once. Heisenberg was saying, no. There is no out there until you get in the mix. And then it starts to emerge, and it emerges according to how you look. John Wheeler once made this quote. He's a physicist who actually studied with Niels Bohr. And he said, there is no law except the law that there is no law. We're looking at a lawless law. We're looking at a new kind of game that's being introduced by Heisenberg's principle of uncertainty that is so bizarre and so difficult to understand that it got almost all of the physicists that were alive, there were around 100 now around 1927, to come together at a hotel, the Hotel Metropole in Brussels, Belgium. It was the first Solvay conference. Now, Solvay was an industrialist. I forgot what country he was from, but he had enough money and he was interested in all these questions that he sponsored this first Solvay conference. And this was in 1927. And all the luminaries of physics were actually there. Born was there. Werner Heisenberg was there. Some new guys that we're going to talk about a little later were also there. Max Planck was there. Louis de Broglie was there. Of course, Albert Einstein was there. And so all of these guys were there to debate this whole thing. And so now the debate began. And the first to enter the ring was Louis de Broglie. And he argued that the waves that Schrödinger had discovered the equation for, that he had first discovered, were real. And he also said, well, it's certainly also a wave of probability, but it's nevertheless a wave anyway. But it's there. It's real. It's real. It's real. And you can imagine how he was received. Most of the physicists sat there and decided that something was wrong with that. And they were wondering what he was going to say next. And then de Broglie says, and the particle is real. And the wave is guiding the particle. And that's what's really what's going on. And the physicists sat and listened again, and they didn't like that at all. Somehow the idea of that bothered them. And so they voted against it. Now, to vote against an idea in physics is very simple. You just don't say anything when the idea is presented. You don't ask any questions. You just ignore the guy. So that's what happened. De Broglie later, a year later, abandoned his so-called pilot waves theory, where the wave is guiding the particle, even though it was going to be picked up later on by David Bohm. We'll talk about that a little later. But nevertheless, this was the idea that was rejected by the faculty. After that, after de Broglie spoke, then came Born and Heisenberg, who at that time were working together, and presented her paper on probability and the probability interpretation of the waves. There were no particles anymore, just probability patterns. And Heisenberg had already said how particles seemed to come into existence. And even though people didn't like the idea, they more or less felt that this was probably in the right direction. Well, after all of this, there was one guy who hadn't spoken yet, who sat in the audience listening, just listening, just listening, not even piping up with a peep of a question. His name, of course, was Albert Einstein, and he had never before actually heard Bohr's new idea on the so-called wave-particle duality, which was then coming up. And what Bohr had called complementarity. We'll talk about that a little later on. But nevertheless, these new ideas were just listened to. And finally, at the end of all this, he began to talk. He got up and he said a few things. He rose from his seat. He looked at the assembly and he says, Entschuldigen mir, excuse me, I have to apologize for not going deeper into this quantum mechanics, but nevertheless, I would like to make some general remarks. And then he said that the following had to be the case. He was imagining an experiment. He asked them to consider the following. This is a very simple thought experiment which you can think about. I want you to imagine a particle that is traveling along. And we understand from the quantum physics that this particle doesn't travel along as a particle, but it exists like a wave, which, like a stone dropped into a pond, makes waves, and the wave travels out in all directions at the same time, just like the wave from a stone dropped in a still pond. And I want you to imagine that the wave keeps going and going and going. And in back of one section of the pond, there is a dish, a little dish which is going to capture the wave. Okay? I want you to imagine this. And however, when the dish captures the wave, the wave doesn't just hit the whole dish at once and make a splash on all of the dish at once. It arrives only at one little point on the dish and makes a boom. What happened to the wave? How did it go from a wave to a boom? How did it go from the wave to the particle? What made it do that? How did it suddenly collapse? This can't make any sense, because how can it change from wave to particle? This is a big hemisphere. It could hit anywhere. How that made it do that? And everybody sat around and realized that nobody knew. Nobody knew how a wave changed into a particle. Now, Heisenberg had said, when you observe it, it changes. But the dish seemed to be doing the observing. Where was the human being in all of this? And then somebody piped up, probably not paid attention to, and said, well, you know, you got to look at the dish to see where it lands. And people heard that. Yeah, you know, you got to look at the dish to see where it lands. But probably people just thought, no, the dish made it happen. And this led to the whole idea that somehow, if you make an experiment, and the experiment is big enough, it could collapse the waves into particles, and thus became this whole other notion that somehow there was something going on in the detection apparatus which made things change. At any rate, what this led to has not been resolved. It's still going on as a debate in the world of physics today. We still don't know fully if there is an out there, independent of what's going on in here. As far as we can tell, somewhere along the line where the buck finally stops is with an observer who has to make the observation. And if that observer doesn't make the observation, even though there's that dish in the pond, the wave would be all over the dish in the pond and wouldn't make a pop pop until somebody actually looks at the dish. And a little later on, I'm going to tell you about some experimental facts that have been observed involving, of all things, parapsychology, which may be telling us that this is going on. I'm not going to tell you this is definite. I'm just going to tell you it's suggestive. And as we get into that area, we're going to be getting into the whole relationship of mind to matter in the human body as we begin to look at how all of this applies to consciousness. So stay tuned for Session 3, The Mind in the Body and What Consciousness Does. See you later.
This concludes Session 2 of Dr. Quantum Presents, A User's Guide to Your Universe with Fred Allen Wolf. Our program continues with Session 3.